The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky. This week, as new data laws are quickly introduced to Parliament before the summer recess, we discuss the implications of the new legislation and why the coalition government and the opposition parties have unified to push this through. Also, the continuing adventure in drone technology and package delivery as online retailer Amazon power ahead in the US with their Prime Air delivery system. Robots, robots everywhere.
We're using the same kind of family of algorithms for our path planning and AI for our cars as Google uses for subsets of their planning. It's just that our cars are meant to sneak up behind you and make your life miserable in the game, and Google's trying to be safe.
Boris Sofman, founder of the robotics company Enki, discusses their first product, Enki Drive. Zippy little toy cars on the outside, powerful self-drive computers on the inside. And we'll be joined by The Guardian's games editor, Keith Stewart, to list his 5 ways to up your gaming skills if you've never touched a console in your life. Rule number 1, put down your controller and enjoy this week's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio to lend their wit and wisdom to today's proceedings is The Guardian's Samuel Gibbs. And for the very first time, we welcome the tech team, Shauna Tregaskis. Welcome, welcome. Shauna, thank you very much for coming in. It's wonderful to have another lady voice.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is the voice with the name, people, the voice with the name. And yo, Sam, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, did you like that? I was referencing the Tech Weekly a couple of weeks ago with the yo.
It was, you know, yo has been fully integrated into our lives now. Once we finished writing a piece, we yo to get it edited.
There you go. That's the user case scenario. That's the user scenario for yo. Well done. And that's why it's worth so much money. We kick off this week with a frantic dash by the UK government to rush through an emergency law that would allow the security services access to our phone and internet records. The bill, despite misgivings from civil rights groups, leading academics, and some backbench MPs, is expected to be rushed through Parliament and the House of Lords before the government takes its summer break from Friday. The speed with which it was introduced and is getting the official nod has discomfited some. To flesh out what this new data law means, I'm joined down the line by Executive Director of the Open Rights Group, Jim Killick. Welcome back to the show, Jim. It's lovely to have you here. First off, this new data law was in part triggered by a European Court of Justice ruling, was it not?
Yes, that's correct. So what's happened is that the directive has been very controversial since it was introduced across Europe as a result of the UK pushing for this, in fact. And it has been challenged in a number of countries, mostly in their domestic courts, and they've often struck it down. I mean, there's no court in Europe that's been asked that hasn't struck it down. About 6 or 7 countries have removed it from their domestic law. And finally, both the Austrian and the Irish governments asked the European Court of Justice to rule on whether it is compatible with the European Charter of Fundamental Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights. So they decided that it, in its current form, wasn't. They didn't say that retention of data could never happen, but they listed a set of things that must happen if you do retain data. The most important of those says that you can't keep data on a blanket basis. It has to be kept as relating to a particular event or threat. So perhaps an ongoing investigation, or perhaps a terrorist cell, or perhaps some public disorder of a particular type that needs data retained for for crime investigation purposes.
For very, very specific reasons. That's the stipulation, effectively, for the request to look at this bill.
Yeah, to retain the data in the first place, that's the criteria. And then there's a second set of criteria to access, which basically mean you have to have some very defined serious crimes for which you can access the data. And you have to have some kind of independent authority, such as a judge, deciding when police or secret services get that data. All of that is absent from the bill. And it's really quite shocking hearing MPs saying, well, we think this is compliant with the judgment, when, or even that the judgment is difficult to read, when actually there are simply 10 paragraphs which set these conditions out one after the other, start off at paragraph 58 and end up at paragraph 68. It's extremely easy to read those 10 paragraphs, and they give you precise instructions as to what this law has to contain to be compatible with European human rights. And those, most of those, and the most two important two, are missing.
Samuel, I'm going to jump over to you because we spoke about the ruling back in early April when the European Court of Justice decided that the bill that they had in place was no longer relevant or appropriate. This, I certainly recall, I think it was last Thursday, which when it was the top headline of the morning news. It was a total surprise to everybody in this country, this emergency drip bill, as it's being called. But the main argument for introducing this and the so-called emergency that has been raised again and again is that this simply reinstates what this ECJ bill repealed, or rather the hole that was left. So is that not what's happening here? Are they not just simply coming in and slapping some solutions on?
Well, that's exactly how the government are trying to play it. The pro-supporters basically say this doesn't actually extend any powers. It's just putting in law something that was already being done before the ECJ ruling. I mean, Lord MacDonald, who's been critical in the past of these kind of actions by the government, said that we need to get back to where we were before the ECJ ruling, and this is the bill to do it. So that is definitely the rhetoric that's coming out of the government.
And Jim, it certainly sounds to me, I mean, this is with the exception of literally one or two critical voices that come from within government, this is what we're hearing almost in a blanket statement. But obviously at the moment we're also going through a reshuffle, a cabinet reshuffle. Do you think this is the time that they decided to throw this together? It just so happens to be a time when the media will be looking elsewhere and not focus on this issue?
I mean, the fact that there's a cabinet debate, cabinet reshuffle going on is one thing, but I think that the thing that's absolutely clear is they have decided to put this in at the very end of the, just before the summer recess. They're given very little time for debate. So whatever else is going on, you're never going to have the level of public debate that is required. And this is quite a serious question. You know, do you retain the data of innocent people on the basis that it might be useful for investigations? Or do you expect the police to be a bit more thorough in their non-surveillance work before they start trying to get hold of data? What do you do here?
Samuel.
Brian Paddock, a Liberal Democrat who was the candidate for the mayoral election but has also been Deputy Assistant Commissioner in his time at the London Met Police. He's very much in favour of the bill and said that, it's an important investigative resource. Of course, we need to balance between data retention and being something that is useful for prosecuting criminals. Where that line comes, I don't know. Paddock said that legislation does not create more intrusive powers, but ensures the existing powers can be exercised when they have data.
And Jim, in addition, there's not just this element of lawful intercept, but there's another element of lawful intercept, which has to do with the international aspect of this bill. Can you describe for me what is being proposed?
Well, it seems that the government is insisting that all of its existing powers to request data or request interception or to gain data from companies that are based overseas, it seems that they're insisting that all of that applies to overseas companies as a matter of course, that they are legally obliged to take those notices. And there is a problem with that because most of those companies are not familiar with UK law often. That's the first problem. And the second problem is that they have to deal with the same kind of demand globally across many, many jurisdictions. And while you might be comfortable with the UK making these demands of American companies, I think we'd be far less comfortable when it comes to, Egypt, Syria, China, Russia making those demands of the same companies. And of course, they'll be able to make the same argument. These are Russians, Chinese, or Syrian citizens using your American services. We need it for our law enforcement. We've defined our law enforcement purposes. You have no right to stop us from using that data. And it's going to make the, at the very least, it's going to make the arguments against that much harder for those companies to hold. So I think at the very least that needs serious debate and consideration, you know, before you just decide to undermine those companies' position defending much more vulnerable people in much more vulnerable circumstances.
And indeed, there were several companies that came out on Tuesday afternoon saying exactly this, that they felt uncomfortable about this. I want to come over to Shauna.
There is a clause in the bill, the extraterritoriality clause, which would provide exemption from jurisdiction. Many people have become concerned that that could be used as a sort of backdoor to provide legal cover for the type of data harvesting programs revealed by Snowden. Do these concerns worry you, Jim?
They do. And I mean, I'll be honest, it is very, very complicated to get a really hard and fast answer on this. I mean, trying to think through how this alters the Regulatory Investigatory Powers Act and how and what it might enable is very, very difficult to know. And even if you feel you do know, if you're worried that there might be some loopholes, you can't really even trust the Home Office in asking for assurance that about what it does and doesn't mean and how it might be used, because we got a lot of those assurances when RIPA was passed. People did ask, you know, could the warrants for overseas persons, for instance, be used for mass collection of data? And they were told absolutely not, and they were paranoid. And of course, now we know that's precisely what's happened. So the Home Office has, unfortunately, a bad track record about being clear about how its powers might be used. And it also has a track record of using powers in very unexpected ways. And for both of those reasons, you have to, I think, with surveillance law, be absolutely sure about what it says and what it does, because you really can't trust any future Home Office and their political demands and their operational concerns. But you just can't trust how those things are going to play out and how they're going to therefore use the laws in front of them when they feel pushed. You have to know by reading the bills what it means, and we're simply not going to establish questions like that with any great certainty in a couple of days.
Jim Killick from the Open Rights Group, thank you very much for your time. We will follow this next week after the dust has settled, and again in 2016 when the real debate is expected to happen. In the meantime, go to theguardian.com for more. Now, I've not picked up a games controller in more than 5 years. And so the idea of playing a game, especially in front of actual gamers, yeah, that's a little bit intimidating to me. So when the opportunity is forced upon me, I need to have some emotional backup. Thankfully, the Guardian Games editor, Keith Stewart, is on hand to provide. Keith, thank you very much for joining us down the line.
My pleasure.
Now, you wrote an article for the tech site this week, very popular article, which included your top tips of things to remember about games for people who don't play them. So start me off easy. What do I need to know?
Well, first of all, I kind of wrote the feature because there's lots of things that game designers take for granted about people that don't play games. There's a language and a series of conventions surrounding games that don't really get spoken about. And so I think the first one really sounds really obvious to gamers, but it's this idea that you should explore environments. Often we play games which have a sort of sense of peril surrounding them, things like Last of Us, you know, the big zombie game that came out last year. And while the cinematic sequences tell you to rush through and watch out for all the enemies and get to this other end where you'll be safe for a few moments, actually, what level designers want you to do is to pause, take a breath, and explore the environment, because they always, essentially, there's so many of them making these games, they spend so much time and effort on creating these vast open world environments. The last thing they actually want you to do is zoom straight through to the end.
But
so
isn't this
that's my first hint.
But isn't this is I mean, this is a, quite a big leap. So say, for example, I hadn't played a game since Pac-Man. I can't really imagine that I would be sort of after I ate everything, I would just kind of be wandering around a little bit more. Even fast forwarding to something like Banjo-Kazooie, which I was just talking about the other night as a game on rails, where you don't really have the opportunity. Every time you kind of went off piste a little bit, you are bounced back into, no, this is where you need to go. Is this not something to do with contemporary games that, you know, all these Easter eggs?
No, I think it's always been there. There have always been kind of on-rail games that have forced you down a particular route and kept you down that route. Ever since the 80s, there's been the ability to explore in video game worlds, but it's often been constrained, but it's been there. If you take, say, Super Mario Brothers or Sonic the Hedgehog, both of those games were quite linear, but they always provided you a few little secret passageways or little things to discover or little treats that rewarded you for exploring and experiencing the game world. And that's kept all the way through games until the present day. But now we're seeing much more in the way of open world games, like, for example, Watch Dogs and Grand Theft Auto 5, where you could, if you wanted, just go from A to B and do all the set missions. But the game designers don't want you to do that. They want to give you the time and the space to explore and discover stuff, and you'll get much more out of the games that way.
So part of this ultimately is about the exploration, and we have spoken in the past, Keith, about the fact that, you know, it's part of the psychology of the gamer that they seek to break the boundaries. They seek to find how far they're allowed to go. And would you say that the technology, despite the fact that, you know, even we were seeing some of these artifacts in the 80s, because the technology has advanced so much, people are now able to explore further? They can almost fall into these rabbit holes more easily and quickly than they would have done in the past?
Yeah, definitely. And one thing, another of the 5 points, the 5 things that I say people need to look out for is this idea that, in fact, everything is telegraphed. Everything that a game wants you to do or provides for you, there's always a message there within the landscape for you to notice. One thing we are seeing with games like Watch Dogs and Far Cry and Grand Theft Auto, these very big games, is that they're kind of codifying exploration into the experience. So you can, if you just go off the beaten track for a few seconds, you might find a character who'll say, hey, I've got a mission for you, why don't you do this? And then suddenly you're into a sort of a side quest. So games are actually very explicit now about wanting you to explore, and they're providing you with things to find and allowing you to almost, in most games now, almost sort of provide you with a sort of Panini sticker book of stuff that you can pick up and collect. And each thing is given a number so that you know how many you have of that certain sort of style of object. So it's very kind of regimented, but it gives you this idea that the games can be a sort of means of exploration, not just a sense of like following a narrative.
That could be quite useful. For example, if you've lost your keys, is there any way to adapt this to the real world so that if I do need to find my keys, then they'll sparkle in the corner? Keith, have we yet yeah. got to that
well,
level?
Well, I don't know, because then maybe you'd have like a scary man in the corner of your room who would
so
say,
good.
I can give you a riddle. Where
No, that's fine. We'll move on. So tell me a little bit. So we've hit two now. We've got designers want you to explore these beautiful environments, and we've got the idea that things are telegraphed.
Yeah.
What else? It's actually leading on from what you just said. Another thing that you mentioned is asset management. You've got, say, 15 sets of keys, as I do in my house.
Yeah.
All of them belong to different things. Half of the time, I don't remember what they are. But anyway, I've got 15 sets of keys. I want to carry them with me. Is this possible? What do I need to think about with games?
Well, often you don't. I think the key thing in modern games is, I talked about asset management or inventory management, if you prefer. Most games these days, action adventure games, allow you to pick up loot from characters. When you've killed a character or when you've discovered a new area, you might find a treasure chest, and that might have lots of different swords and armor in it. And for like new gamers, they might think, oh my goodness, I've got to try and carry all of this. What does it all mean? What am I going to do if I drop this particular sword and I need it later in the level? And what I've kind of said is, these days, that rarely, rarely happens. What game designers want you to do is form your own way of playing. So every time they give you a bit of loot, like a weapon, everything will have like a series of stats attached to it. How good is it at attack? How good is it at defense? Is it best for like long-range attacks, or is it best for short-range attacks? You will know as you play a game what you're good at. Are you better at hitting enemies really close, or are you better at doing it further away and sort of hanging back? And you then collect the objects that are better for your approach. It's all about personalization these days.
Now, Keith, you mentioned in the article that games are systems, and systems have rules, and rules are meant to be followed. But everything that we've talked about so far is that you kind of want to break the rules. Is this another one of your? Is this another one of the top tips?
That's it, definitely. As I say, in the feature, Jonathan Smith, who's the producer of the LEGO games, I was talking to him once, interviewing him a couple of months ago, and he was telling me that effectively every single game designer, anyone that makes a game, isn't really an engineer, because games are systems, they're machines. Everything within the game, from the baddies that are patrolling a level to the way the camera works to the way the landscape is designed, they're all part of a system of puzzles, a machine to tease and challenge the player. And what you've got to do is work out how to subvert or break that machine, reading the environment, reading the enemies, and understanding what is the developer trying to tell me at this point in time.
That's absolutely fine in a physical environment, because that's how we operate in a physical environment. But you do have to make a kind of leap when you're going into something that is on a screen. You know, you have to adapt your spatial awareness. And that's your final top tip, is that spatial awareness is more important than speed. That kind of encompasses, it seems to me, a lot of the other elements. So, you know, for example, wander around your environment and you'll find different things that will help you, that will bring you success later on. But if I'm, you know, physically situated in the physical world, then what am I going to do if I don't know how to do spatial awareness inside the virtual one?
Well, I think, again, it's about this really is about understanding your role in the game world, and understanding that the best when people go into shooters, say, for the first time, often they'll think, right, what I need to do is just run and shoot stuff as I'm running along, and that's probably going to get me through. Or in a racing game, they'll think, if I thump down the accelerator, then that's the best way of reaching the pack when I've got behind, in something like Gran Turismo. But what I mean by spatial awareness in this context is understand what the game environment is asking of you. So even though it's on a screen, you can still tell if you're approaching a corner in a racing game, for example, there's no point in accelerating around that corner from the start. You have to understand that the physics of a game world is, or just like in real life, you go through, you hit the racing line, you take the corner at a tangent, and you accelerate after the apex. So it's not about thrusting your way into these worlds. In first-person shooters as well, you have to understand where all the enemies are in the environment. You have to look around and again, read that and understand where they are, so that you know the order with which you're expected to shoot people, because that will always kind of help you get through. It's very rarely the case that you can just sort of run into an environment and not look around you and shoot. So really, that was the idea. Video games are about, I've made this point, that video games are about creating a series of safe spaces. Video games are always about making a little bit of progress, understanding where you are, looking back, looking forwards, looking around, and then creating that safe point, and then working out how you can create the next one. So, and this works for any game. Like Tetris is essentially a space in which you create safety. But the safety is the lines at the bottom. You have to understand how each object falling down the screen is going to help you create that safe space. And what a lot of people find is the one straight piece, the sort of the four dot, the really long piece, is the one that actually, nine times out of ten, is the one that helps you create that safe space. So, and that's a sort of lesson lots of people learn very, very quickly. And that's how you have to think about games.
Thank you very much, Keith. I will. I'll look for the twinkling lights around my keys. Avoid the GRU that's standing behind the cupboard, and make sure that I find a safe space in
exactly.
My house next time.
You just got to understand how your flat works,
Alex. Well, it does have a lot of things that fold up and down. So I still haven't discovered all of the secret compartments. Who knows? There might be an Easter egg in there. For more on this, plus tips from the Guardian's thriving games community, go to theguardian.com/games, and rest assured that we have your psychological well-being at heart. Just before Christmas last year, we covered a story that, for many of you, was at once both thrilling and ridiculous. The best stories in technology, of course, always are. But this one, however, was greeted with more skepticism than usual from Charles Arthur. The story covered Amazon, the online retailer, and their use of drones to deliver packages in, as I was obsessed with, tidy plastic orange boxes. Now, Charles is away at the moment. However, we do have our crack team of drone experts in the house, in the studio. Shauna and Sam, please tell me, what is the latest, Sam?
Biggest issue is that it can't test them, or at least it can't test them at home. It has to test them outside of the US. So this story is essentially them asking for permission to test them in the US. And it's kind of like, yes, we seriously are asking for permission, but really this is quite good publicity because this seems to have captured the public's imagination. Just getting things delivered by a drone, no longer having to wait for the delivery man. It just appears magically out of the sky. But whether it really happens, I'm not sure.
Well, they're calling this their Prime Air delivery system, aren't they? So, you know, somebody somewhere inside of Amazon, Shauna, there is a strategy for this, even if it's just to come up with the silly name.
Yeah, I mean, they're not thinking about it properly, are they? Because it is a logistical nightmare. I mean, for all the people who live in tower blocks, all the people who don't have a front garden, how are they going to get their parcels? And also, how long is it going to take before someone files a lawsuit because a book dropped on their head?
Very good point. Yeah. Very, very. And actually, the tower block issue was actually something that we raised. It was the video that was released just before Christmas was, you know, lovely suburban house, beautiful back garden.
White picket fence.
White picket
fence. And that's just not our reality.
Not in my lifetime, that's for sure. No. I got a few more points to get before I get there. But actually, what this was, the reason why this has come up is because somebody, the head of publicity, funnily enough, at Amazon, Paul Meisner, has written a letter. What's in the letter? What is this letter?
Well, essentially, it's a letter to the FAA, the Federal Aviation Authority, which our equivalent in the UK is the CAA, the Civil Aviation Authority. And it's basically the government agency that governs air travel over the airspace and regulation of what can and can't fly. And as I said before, at the moment, the use of drones in the US is a bit dodgy because the FAA says no, and a recent ruling by a judge has said that actually small drones can be used commercially in the US without regulation. So anyway, it's a bit dodgy there. But Amazon's basically asking the FAA, can we have permission to test these things? We want to fly a drone that can carry something in the region of 2.3 kilos at up to 50 miles an hour for 30 minutes.
Do we know how many parcels Amazon delivers daily in the
Good
UK?
Good Lord. Actually, I mean, can you imagine these things zipping over our heads?
So if they're doing, if it's one drone an hour for each parcel there and back again to pick up the next, that's hundreds of thousands of drones.
Absolutely.
Swarming the skies.
And it's not, you know, you would think that there would be a better logistical way of doing this, like, for example, in a larger container so they can take it to, you know, your Amazon locker or somewhere where it's not at your house.
You're thinking far too logically. You need a helicarrier drone, right, that flies over the top, and then mini drones then descend and drop off.
Oh, wow.
You see, that's what we really need.
That's why you're good at this. Yeah. I wish I had such imagination. I didn't draw those, the sort of the distribution drones at the top. Yeah. So basically what we're saying is we want storehouses in the sky. That sounds really safe. Doesn't it? Howl's Moving Castle, but, you know, static right above your head.
I mean, I've got a vision of a sort of little groups of train spotter-like thieves hanging around outside the distribution centres with their air rifles or slingshots or just a rock, maybe, to knock the thing out of the sky and then run and grab the parcel and...
It's a lucky dip. You have no idea what you're going to get.
There for the taking, though, isn't it?
I mean, are Amazon then just going to send another one? I mean, how do you get your parcel?
Who's going to pay?
Very,
right.
Very good point. But actually, Charles does raise some interesting things about drones in the US. You know, the current limit on drones are things like battery life and line of sight regulation. So, you know, what he does raise in this article is sort of where we're at in terms of what we're thinking about with these relatively autonomous vehicles in the sky.
So, I mean, at the moment, realistically, you can expect something to be able to travel 25 miles, more or less. That's still an advanced drone. Now, when we're talking military drones, you know, and these are not battery powered, they're often petrol powered, and they're much more like a helicopter, they can do 200 kilometers, no problem. But in the realm of what Amazon can pull off and what actually would be allowed to fly over US airspace, we're thinking much more like 25 miles. But I mean, that would be perfectly fine. If you put that map on, say, London, right, you could reach most of the Greater London with some central hub. We could easily get out to the M25 and, you know, traveling 50 miles an hour for half an hour, direct line of sight, no traffic, bang, it would get you there. In the US, of course, much larger scales. Where are these things actually going to deliver? I mean, you stick one in the middle of a state, it's only going to really, you know, ring
fence.
It's
going to go to the next cow field over there. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. I mean, and then you try and do them in cities. Can you imagine them flying around New York?
Our children aren't going to know whether the thing flying above their head is, you know, is biological, is a bird, or is a drone. I can see this in our future. That actually I did fantasize about when I was a kid, but I never did think about this crazy distribution thing. Well, we shall continue to follow this story on theguardian.com/technology as new information arises. For any young tech startup, being invited to launch your first product by Apple CEO Tim Cook as part of the annual Developers Conference is a vote of confidence indeed. Well, that's what happened to Boris Sofman and his company Anki at last year's Apple Developer Conference. So why so much interest by the tech giant in a small robotics startup launching Anki Drive, a range of clever toy cars that look little more than an update on the classic Skeletrix racing cars? Because what's driving Anki's toy cars is not so dissimilar to the technologies employed by Google in its self-driving car technology. And what works in a toy today could have a major impact in various transport and industry sectors tomorrow. To find out just how serious Anki Robotics is, The Guardian's Charles Arthur met up with founder Boris Sofman to find out more.
So you actually have a self-driving car that people can buy now. Although it's not the one that a lot of people might think about if one says self-driving car. Just describe the self-driving cars that you have.
Our self-driving cars are smaller. It's a game that you play. It's kind of like a video game in the real world where they're robotic cars. You can control them, but whichever ones you don't control, they drive themselves. They compete against you. They have their own personalities and weapons and special abilities. And you can use them to play a video game, but in physical form in front of you on the floor.
So these are sort of Skeletrix-sized cars, slightly scaled up from that. I mean, about what, sort of twice the size, perhaps, of that.
That's right. So they're fairly small, but they are packed with a lot of technology. They have, each of them has a 50 megahertz computer inside of them. They sense and understand their environment 500 times a second. They're thinking about what they need to do and how they want to do it. And they're making use of mobile devices that run the game as kind of the brains behind this experience.
And you were featured on the stage at Apple's WWDC of 2013, and that was a fairly stressful moment. I think Apple was sort of trying to have a joke about self-driving cars because Google had been in the news a bit.
Apple's version, that's right. That was an amazing experience. Definitely an honor, but added a little bit of stress to your life. And as you can imagine, they take that pretty seriously. And so for us, that was also a pretty special moment because it was the first time we publicly announced anything about the company. So all of a sudden, like, that's quite a way to launch. We kind of got thrown into the deep end. We kind of dealt with everything that came out of that. But it was fantastic because it gave us a chance to tell the story, not just of the product that was coming later on that fall, but to really talk about how we're bringing robotics and artificial intelligence into consumer products to reinvent categories to do things that you would never expect to be possible. And for Apple, it was great because we're using their product ecosystem in a way that nobody had ever used it before.
So what you have is, the product that people can buy at the moment is a track that you lay out on the floor. You need a fair bit of floor, and it needs to be pretty flat floor, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And the cars then whiz around it at a speed equivalent to 250 miles an hour.
Yeah, so if you took one of our cars, so we're kind of geeks at heart on our end, and so we actually did the math, and if you scaled it up to real-world size. At peak performance, it's as if you were driving a car 250 miles an hour on a highway with a concrete wall on either side of your car, a tenth of an inch from each of your mirrors. And so that's how precisely the cars can drive. And it's because they're using a huge amount of software on board to control themselves incredibly precisely. And the cool thing is that even when you're driving them, the cars are actually helping you execute these motions. So in the end, it's kind of this interesting loop where we have characters that understand exactly where they're located. They can move very precisely. They can communicate. And so we can just abstract away everything that's physical and just treat them as if they're just video game characters, virtual characters in a mobile device. And so we're literally programming a video game on top of them, on top of these characters in the real world. But whatever intentions we want, down to that level of precision, we can actually make it happen. And that's what makes it so special.
I mean, a lot of people have heard about Google's self-driving car because it seems to get announced about every 6 months or so. You were, I think, one of the team at Carnegie Mellon University where you studied, sort of who worked with the same group who's now at Google, and you sort of split off, basically.
Yeah, so it's a lot of the same friends. So basically, the Google autonomous car, they basically took Carnegie Mellon's autonomous car team, part of Stanford's autonomous car team, and a few other scattered people, and combined them into Google's team. So it's all the same colleagues. The lead of the project was on my thesis committee, so it's a lot of close friends. And then it's kind of very related to the work I did in my PhD at Carnegie Mellon, where I worked on autonomous vehicles, but for off-road environments where you're more in a kind of a forest and having to figure out whether it's safe to go through this foliage or go over this bush, or should you go around, and how do you navigate to this waypoint, 10 kilometers away. And so the interesting thing is that all of the technologies that we used in these types of projects, whether it was autonomous driving, like structured environments, off-road, or just general robotics, they carry over incredibly well. We just had to reinvent a lot of these solutions to work at a price point and reliability that makes sense for a consumer product. That was the biggest challenge. So we had in my case, I went from a $800,000 robot in a lab to one that is available at a consumer price point, but is expected to have very similar level of intelligence and functionality. But you'd be surprised how much of those algorithms actually carry over incredibly well.
So the sort of techniques that you're using in the cars, the things that make them able to react like, as you described, video game characters, this is all sort of AI neural networks, sort of a deep learning. There seems to be an emerging theme in computing at the moment is trying to build intelligence into devices so that they're, in effect, autonomously able to sort of react to things.
Yeah.
How is that developing? I mean, why is this such a big drive at the moment?
Yeah, so a lot of it is because you see this like hardware mobile ecosystem that's really converging in a way that's never happened before, and it's happening in an exponential rate. So one of our cars, each one of our cars has a 50 megahertz computer inside of it. That's crazy because if you think, like, my first computer was a 33 megahertz and it cost $2,500, and that was only after you pushed a turbo button to get it up from 16 megahertz. and so now you suddenly have this 50 megahertz component that costs very, very little. And likewise, we have wireless chips, we have camera module, we have batteries, motors, and all of this is driven by the cell phone industry. And so suddenly an application that was either impossible or would have been prohibitively expensive, you can start thinking about how to cleverly put together these components to do interesting things. And when the way I think about robotics is it's just the extension of computer science into the physical world, where the moment you have something that can understand its position in the environment and can interact with it, you can start using software to make it intelligent, functional, give it a personality, and do whatever you need to do. And so with this sort of quickly diminishing costs that you have in sensors and computation, you can start putting these combinations together where you can bring a level of intelligence that has never been possible outside of research into consumer products, but at price points that are surprising. And frankly, things that seem impossible today, 3 more years from now, will actually become possible.
What sort of things can you put your sort of intelligence or robotics into?
Yeah, it's actually quite exciting because from the very beginning, we didn't start the company to be a toy company or even an entertainment company, but to truly be a robotics and artificial intelligence company where there are these technologies that that carry over into all these different applications, and they actually are quite robust, independent of what you want to apply them to. So, for example, we're using the same kind of family of algorithms for our path planning and AI for our cars as Google uses for subsets of their planning. It's just that our cars are meant to sneak up behind you and make your life miserable in the game, and Google's trying to be safe. But in the process of making Drive, it's not just a one-off effort. It was a very intentionally chosen product where we have an ability to develop these core functionalities in robotics that are practical for consumer use. So positioning systems, motion control, wireless communications, AI path planning, interface systems, you know, mass production. And now we're building up this growing base of technology and expertise where as we look ahead to our second, third, fourth product, we can look at more and more ambitious applications that wouldn't be possible as a first. So it's kind of a bottoms-up approach to robotics where there's, you know, at one extreme, there's kind of the holy grails where you want to build a humanoid robot that serves you around the house, but we're nowhere close to it, neither in terms of cost practicality or intelligence or use case or even people's psychological kind of perception of robots to be able to embrace that. And so for us, we're taking the bottoms-up approach where we're trying to make the highest impact, most kind of disruptive to an industry application that we can make today and use that as stepping stones to more and more ambitious things. And so in the case of the first product, we're pretty much we're going head on with the toy industry, which has been a really massive industry, but hasn't really, you know, innovated too much in decades. We're the same sort of toys that we played with still make up the toys today. But we can, for the first time, bring software to completely redefine that experience in a way that's never been possible in the space. And so as we look ahead, the exact same technologies that we're building now, we can go and use in other applications like in the home, in sports, down the road in transportation and healthcare. And they actually carry over incredibly well with just adjustments for the different constraints and price points.
So you're describing something where you sort of, first you build it into these, you know, comparatively small cars, and then it can be built into larger and larger objects that need robotics, that needs AI, whereas Google has taken a sort of a big bang approach of, okay, we're going to build an autonomous car. It's going to, you know, replace the car that you have in your drive. So, I mean, their approach needs a lot of funding, obviously, but they've got that. Your approach is a sort of a more accretive one, I guess. But again, the difficulty is how, you know, can you sustain it on the consumer sales of sort of, you know, the car thing in order to build up to the area, the areas you're going for.
And of course, we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think that the Drive would be a really successful franchise where, you know, there's a genre that we've all grown up with from, you know, racing games, slot car sets, you know, video games like Mario Kart and so forth. And this is kind of like the next generation where it's brought into physical form where you can combine the physical attachment with characters with all of the kind of virtual elements and magic that you're only used to in the video game. Like, you know, frankly, the fact that you can sit down and play against three robotic cars and actually have competition without having anybody nearby, that's kind of unprecedented. And so we want that to be successful because that allows us to build on not just all the technological elements, but also the brand of the company and the our ability to really create these new categories of products. Because the sort of challenges that we're having now to reinvent people's perceptions, that becomes easier from product to product. When we look at like Google, so you know, you mentioned Google specifically. They're a special case because it's actually quite incredible how they're approaching it. Because it's rare for a company that big to actually fund a project like this, but be conscious enough not to meddle in it and kind of ruin the ability for the people to actually bring this to life.
I mean, what you're describing about how the cars, when you're controlling the car is also aware of it. It sounds rather like what a lot of the car companies, you know, the actual vehicle makers are doing, where they don't talk about self-driving cars. They talk about driver-assisted, where they talk about the cars sort of interacting with the driver, but, you know, still someone behind a steering wheel who is deciding where the car goes. And the car just says, yeah, it wouldn't go quite there, actually, I would, you know, and sort of assisting in that way. It sounds like what you're describing is more like the driver-assisted approach of the vehicle makers than the Google replace the person sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, so the thing is, we have both in the game. So when you're driving a car, it's still assisting you. So it's actually still sensing the environment. It's adjusting its motor commands 500 times a second, trying to helping you execute and drive far beyond your means. In fact, it's a system that allows a 4 or 5 year old to play and get a lot of help and not drive off the track and have these virtual buffers. As well as when you and I play, we can get really competitive and start thinking about the strategies. But the cars that we're not controlling, they're fully autonomous. So they are fully driving themselves. They're reacting to what we're doing, what you would be doing with your car, what I'm doing. They have their own personalities. And so one might be aggressive, one might be more sneaky and kind of defensive. They make use of their capabilities, the items, the weapons, and the special abilities that they've been equipped with. And so in that sense, they're fully autonomous, reacting to everything that's happening around them.
So just on the products that you're looking at now, what are the limiting factors? I mean, I'm guessing that Moore's Law is increasing the processing power, onboard storage is falling in price. Is the battery the hard thing to do, the battery life?
I think battery life is something that would help every application, and it's one of the pieces that hasn't really improved a huge amount. But you work within constraints, and usually it's just you either have to have something that's permanently powered or you have a little bit more of an inconvenience to recharge. I'd say more than anything, it's just it ends up being cost constraints. So in the case of what we're doing here, it's a functionality, like understanding very precise positions of something that we'd done in labs at Carnegie Mellon and in research and robotics in general, using motion capture systems, but that used to cost thousands of dollars in very dedicated environments. And so the hard part is being clever in how you constrain a problem to work around the sort of constraints that you're talking about so that you're constraining it. But in reality, that constraint is not a huge hindrance to the task at hand. And that's the trick in the creativity of robotics in general. And there's some beautiful examples of companies that have taken a problem. They constrain it so that the 5 or 10% that's exponentially more difficult than anything else is either solved by a human or just kind of abstracted away, and they solve 80, 90% of the problem in a really effective way and have a massive impact on efficiency, reliability, or functionality.
Such as, what's an example?
So an example is Kiva Systems. So I don't know if you're familiar with the company that Amazon bought a couple years ago. It's a warehouse management, it's robots to manage warehouses. And so you can imagine these shelves that store everything that might be ordered in a warehouse, like an Amazon warehouse, for example. And these robots are these big kind of orange robots that cost about $10,000 each, but they're fully expandable and kind of customizable in terms of the overall system. And somebody places an order that it contains these five items, and these robots that are like an ant farm, they'll go and automatically grab the shelves that contain those orders, bring them, and like line them up in line at a checkout system. And so so they'll automatically manage the locations and orientations of all of these shelves. They'll track your inventory. They'll know when something's out of stock. They'll keep the more often used items towards the outside and the less often used items towards the inside. And in the end, all that the person has to do is at the checkout counter, they grab the boxes off the shelf and pack them. And that's a brilliant solution because the manipulation of actually grabbing a box and packing it in somewhere is actually very complicated and also very expensive. Mm. But it takes 5% of the time because once you have everything in front of you, you just pick and place and they'll even shine a laser on what you need to pick up and close it. But the thing that's most time consuming is going and searching for this item in a massive warehouse. Right. And they've solved this perfectly by having this system with a warehouse that's engineered to have little barcodes on the ground so you can detect where you are. These robots understand it. They go and pick everything up and bring it to you. And in effect, what they've done is they've shaved a huge amount of time and cost off of this operation. And I think it's one of the most brilliant purchases that Amazon could make because when you scale that to their entire infrastructure, they'll have a like logistics and supply chain advantage that nobody else will be able to compete with.
Should we worry? I mean, people have been talking about robotics, the advance of robotics, robotic factories. You're describing, robotic picking there. Should we be worried about robotics taking away people's jobs?
I think it's one of those things that, for every situation where it takes away somebody's job, it creates new industries that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. And you could say the same thing about computers when they first came out. There's a lot of things that people did manually that on a local scale took away people's job when computers started kind of becoming more prevalent. But you would never make an argument that it was a negative thing that computers did what they did, because when you zoom forward a couple of decades, it reinvented almost every aspect of our lives and operations of every business. And I think robotics will be looked on in the same way, where we can start making products that were never possible before. We can start having functionality that was never possible before. And even though it'll disrupt some ecosystems of jobs, in the short term, that'll hurt some sectors. But in the long term, it'll enable new businesses and new operations for just society in general that are going to be massive positives as a whole.
Boris Sofman, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to Boris Sofman, and we will have links to Anki Drive on the blog for this podcast. Now, Charles is away for a little while, but if you watch his latest video, not only will you have that heartwarming sense of seeing him more recently than you will be hearing him on this podcast, but you'll also understand why he's decided to go off-grid.
In the films, if an evil corporation or government wants to follow you, they slip a tracking device onto your car or your shoes or whatever. Of course, now we carry smartphones everywhere, a personal GPS beacon that makes it easier for people to know what you're up to, whether that's your mum, your partner, or your boss.
Yes, if you want to gain some insight into how and why your phone is tracking you, watch Charles's short film on the topic at theguardian.com/technology. That's all we have for you this week. Thanks to our awesome technology team, to Jim Killick, and also to Keith Stewart. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps and presented by me, Alex Kratowski. We are back next Wednesday. See you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.